FCC, especially to, I think, the many people here today who are not FCC members. I see quite a few members of the Hong Kong Club. To them, I'd say if you want to upgrade your club, pick up an application on your way out. We have better speakers than the Hong Kong Club. If you haven't already turned off your mobile, please do so now. Also, a quick reminder that on Monday, Jonathan Lash of the World Resources Institute will be here. And next Thursday, the 23rd, John Greenwood, chief economist of Invesco, and better known to some of you as father of Hong Kong's dollar peg, will talk about recovery prospects for Asia's economies over the remainder of this year and next. Today, however, we travel back in time with Edward Stokes, a photographer and writer who is well known, I'm sure, to most of you. Ed has photographed, written, and edited some remarkable books, including a trilogy that retraced the roots of some of Australia's greatest explorers, not long after he was a teacher in the Australian outback. You will probably be more familiar with another of Ed's books, Hong Kong's Wild Places, which was published in 1995. It certainly opened my eyes to the beauty of Hong Kong's landscape, which in turn has been one of the reasons I find it so hard to ever imagine leaving this incredible city. Ed's more recent work has focused on photographic archives, culminating in another unique book, Hedda Morrison's Hong Kong, and the establishment of the Photographic Heritage Foundation. The foundation has recently released a new edition of Hedda Morrison's photographs titled Hong Kong As It Was. There are copies here if you'd like to purchase that. And as you will soon hear, Ed's serendipitous discovery of Hedda Morrison's work, first in a Hong Kong government publication and then libraries at Harvard and Cornell, put him on the trail of other collections of regional photographs. Ed, thanks for coming to the FCC today.
Thanks, Tom. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for coming. Members of the FCC, guests of Dr. Soman, Foundation guests, ladies and gentlemen. My talk today reflects on time and place, on cultures and people, and also on journeys. Hong Kong in 1946. It reflects on the journeys, as Tom was saying, of earlier photographers as they sought out their images and the journey to develop the foundation. The foundation, as it was being built, has received very generous assistance and support. And all those named here on this frame are very sincerely thanked, above all, Dr. Helmut Soman. The Foundation's plans and partnerships radiate out from Hong Kong to Singapore, Australia, the United States, and the United Kingdom. Each person named here helped very greatly with advice, assistance, encouragement, and above all, generous time. And I take great pleasure in thanking here today especially the Foundation Chairman, Helmut Hennig, its board members, Robert Shum, Lindsay Esler, Peter Ahern, John Richardson and Phil McDonald of Deakins, Victor Chang of the Design Associates, Norman DeBracking and Stephen Stringer, our printing advisors, Hong Kong University Press, represented today by Winnie Chow, and a very warm welcome and thanks to friends here today. And a very special thanks to a great friend of my parents, Cheng Wing In, QCOBA, and Desmond. Hedda Morrison, whose photographs form Hong Kong As It Was, the Foundation's first book, was born Hedda Hammer in Germany in 1908. Her images will also contribute to our future books, building on her remarkable archive that Tom mentioned of Asian photographs that span 30 years. Of Morrison's some 60,000 negatives held at Harvard and Cornell, about 10,000 have great historical, cultural, and social meaning. Yet, only about 1,000 of them have ever been seen, have ever been published. So it seems natural to begin this talk by remembering Hedda Morrison. Open, engaging, always alive to situations and life around her, resolved and determined, dedicated, committed to her vocation, willing to do almost anything to bring back her images. In varying ways, those same attributes apply to all the photographers whose work the Foundation hopes to publish from. Like Hedda, each of them set out to record Asia on film. Yet, despite the quality of their work, for personal or other reasons, many remain little published today. And that surely is a loss today to the places portrayed. My talk today will say, very briefly indeed, something about the Foundation, why and how it was set up, and I'll show some photos from our intended books. But first, to get a sense of historical photographs, of what they communicate to us today, let's follow Hedda Morrison through the Hong Kong of 1946, a place and period she recorded so well, as seen in Hong Kong as it was. Where the Mandarin stands today. Still recognisable as Pottinger Street. The writer Shirley Hazard met Morrison in 1947 in Hong Kong, and Hazard later wrote, "Hedda's work conveyed the light in which we moved, the action and the architecture of Hong Kong, panoramas and infinite details, the candour of sweated toil, the plaited sheen of conical hat." Surely a powerful image, framed by planks and masts, revealing muscle and sinew, and, if you look closely, the misery of tropical ulcers. The latter were discerned by Jason Wordy, who helped greatly in drawing out the hidden meanings, the details of these Hong Kong photographs. Until my own photo research began at Harvard, these Hong Kong images were effectively unknown. The 1,000-odd Hong Kong negatives occupied less space than a shoebox. As sometimes happens, especially with large collections, the negatives simply had slipped through the cataloguing system. And therein lies a message for this foundation. What is cultural heritage? Norman DeBrackey, a foundation advisor and a photographer himself, put it thus in an email to me when first thinking about the foundation. Heritage awareness, Norman wrote, is not just the preservation of buildings, but the reading of previous ways of life, the appreciation of their overlapping contours with the present. To me, that puts it well. And it also suggests why, in representing the heritage today, historical photographs speak powerfully. Let's briefly explore Hong Kong's fishing communities as they were in 1946. Sculled sampans, hemp ropes, sail-powered junks, fishermen's intuition. And despite the very real hardships, lives of sea-net community. Shaki Wan. Today, all this has changed irrevocably, materially, of course, mostly for the better. Yet the heritage of South China fishing communities deserves our remembering. It's that recall or remembrance, inspired and framed by photographs, with context from balanced research, avoiding nostalgic, romantic views of the past, that is, in fact, the central rationale for the Foundation's existence and for its plans. Believe it or not, Kowloon Bay. The discovery in 1998 of Hedda Morrison's Hong Kong photographs, the publication, as Tom was saying, in 2005 of Hedda Morrison's Hong Kong, and its positive reception, they were the combined sparks that led to thinking of a series of further such books, thus to thinking of an organization to publish them. For the story of Hedda Morrison's Hong Kong, now retold in the introduction to Hong Kong as it was, revolved around a very common situation. In brief, that countless invaluable photographs of Asia and of other regions often remain lost to view, hidden, if you like, amidst the institutions that hold them. Not only that, even if known to the holding institutions, they simply lack the means, the resources, the time to publish them. So given that, could an enterprise be developed to meet this research, this publishing need, to locate and identify historical images and archives and private collections, to revive their context and meaning, above all, to publish them in books, websites, and exhibitions? And if so, how might such a publishing entity be tasked, planned, resourced? For it to originate a steady series of books, broadly similar to Hedda Morrison's Hong Kong. Those were the key questions that led the investigations leading to the foundation. During that time, I researched significant photographic collections in the United States, particularly Harvard and Cornell, Europe, Australia, Singapore. The resulting images were to be the future body's primary building blocks, in a sense, its working capital. Meanwhile, I was discussing partnerships with the photo collection institutions, exploring how the envisaged body and its books could benefit their own plans, their profile, their hopes, through publications and other shared outcomes. I also met with writers interested to contribute text. For the planned books, undoubtedly, would need specialist writers, experts who know places like Nanjing, Singapore, or Sarawak inside out. From the start, guided by the concept behind Hedda Morrison's Hong Kong and the book's success, its critical reviews, we decided that the Foundation's publications must combine rigorous scholarship and also fine reproduction. The fronts of books, we hope, will be lively, engaging, visually striking. The backs of books, for sure, will be loaded with research information. To complement the books, of course, the contents of each will go online for the widest possible dissemination. Together, we hope, we intend, with photographs of the places as they are today. Printing and paper in a Hong Kong backstreet alley. The Foundation will seek to have its books as widely read and, of course, bought as possible. But its publications, given their nature, are unlikely to be profit-making. Indeed, a fundamental aim, the core reason why the Foundation was set up as a not-for-profit body, will be to publish books that commercial publishers largely must ignore because of lengthy research time, high origination costs, and thus modest returns. In this, we share the financial paradigm of many cultural institutions and indeed most university presses, which typically are heavily subsidized. Our immediate funding plans rest on corporate sponsorship for specific projects, which should allow us, which in fact, will allow us to bring out our first three books and so prove the Foundation's potential. After that, the financial objective must be to establish ongoing program funding, the essential requirement for such a body to work at its best. Only sustained funding will allow the Foundation to prioritize its projects, commission high-caliber writers, and ensure excellent design and print. In short, to bring out an ongoing series of substantial books with predictable timing and lasting quality. During 2008, as the Foundation's organization was being planned, key publishing components were being refined: the future books, design style, and print aims. Design, development, and print testing, above all, require teamwork. The processes are painstaking and, believe me, very time-consuming. Yet the evolution is a pleasure to witness as the page templates and press proofs gradually coalesce to promise actual finished books, the sum greater than their parts. The Foundation's logo, created by Victor Chang here today, suggests what we hope our books will become known for: liveliness with strength, visual interest with content, and, we hope, above all, that elusive quality balance. These few photographs were taken 6 weeks ago when Hong Kong as it was being printed in Singapore. Victor, our designer, is in the blue striped shirt. The other people are the Singapore pressmen. And here I must pause to thank the two companies involved for work that has shown great levels of professional commitment, artistic endeavor, and relationships that we know will endure. And so I thank, in Hong Kong, our designer, the Design Associates, and Victor Chang. And also here today, from TDA, Philip Soon, Vicky Lee, and Simon Wong. And in Singapore, I thank our printer, CS Graphics, and Linus Lee. Truly, design and printing are all about teamwork. This was at the end of the printing when we were just about to do the cover. Let's now look at some of the photographs the Foundation hopes to publish. All are from what you might call hidden collections, images known only to a few specialists and sometimes not even known to the institutions that hold them, in the sense of knowing the provenance, the meaning of the photographs. Whole bodies of work by photographers little known or unknown that portray specific times and places. A number of books already are clearly in view, based on memorable collections that portray China, especially Fujian in 1868, Nanjing and Jiangsu in the 1930s, Japan and Hong Kong in the late 1940s, Singapore and Sarawak in the 40s and 50s, and a collection that documents beautifully the ports of Asia in the 1930s. Here then is a sampling of what's to come, seen today with low-resolution process images and with minimal comments from myself. Afong. The single Chinese photographer of China in the 19th century who retains a distinct place in history. Superb album and prints of 1868 of Fu Chao and the beautiful River Min. From an album in Europe, completely unknown until we looked into it as to what it actually was. And in a very real sense, the first landscape photographs of China by a Chinese, because in the period 1870 about, almost all Chinese photographers were portrait photographers. Afong was decades ahead of his time. A wonderful story here. In 1944, Hedda Morrison was commissioned to photograph Nanking, and a text was written by a German sinologist. The book, you see it here, was coincidentally published a week before the Japanese surrender, printed in Shanghai. The entire edition disappeared without trace. Not a copy can be found in a library, almost certainly burnt in fires because fuel was so short and there was civic chaos. This copy here is the sole remaining copy. It's Hedda's copy, now held in an Australian institution. The negatives, the images, all exist at Harvard. Every one is brilliant or more brilliant, in fact, than the photographs of Hong Kong. And publishing this project will be not only bringing the photographs back to Nanjing, but in a very real sense, bringing back a vanished book. In the early 1950s, Qantas commissioned photographs of Singapore, and these are held in an Australian institution. Photo historians in Singapore regard these as exemplars of photographs of Singapore of that time. Many oblique aerial views, some streetscapes, and these, with the rich store of photographs in the Singapore National Archives, rather the National Archives of Singapore, using their photographs, their documentary work, to flesh this out, will, we hope, become a wonderful book of Singapore in its modern crucible years, the 1950s. This set of photographs are not strictly a foundation project, but I've included them here for this reason. Once again, they reveal a story of lost, or if you like, forgotten photographs by Robin Adsett, who lived in Hong Kong at this time, the 60s, now in the trust of Bob Davis, who recently mounted a beautiful exhibition at the FCC of these photographs. They show a Hong Kong so far removed from the one we know today, a place struggling with its waves of refugees, its squatter shacks and its early public housing. And Bob's work with these photos epitomizes what we believe, that photos such as these deserve to be given a fresh audience today. Finally, Ports East. Wonderful photographs of the ports of Asia, Singapore, Manila, Jakarta, obviously Hong Kong, and above all the China coast, Fuzhou, Shanghai, Tientsin. These photographs are held in a place so far from Asia, it's almost impossible to believe they are photographs of Asia. But indeed they are. Found recently by somebody traveling on the other side of the world in an organization protecting forever the legacy of this photographer's work. Canton, Shanghai, sail and steam. When the historical projects allow, the foundation will also publish contemporary urban and nature landscape images to add our voice to the need for urban heritage preservation and nature conservation. The Foundation's second book, to be published late this year, will be a retrospective of my own Hong Kong nature photos, mainly taken in the 1990s and thereabouts. And I'm most pleased to say, to announce, that the book is kindly sponsored by the MTR Corporation and the Kowloon Canton Railway Corporation. I do emphasize that the majority of our future publications will be by commissioned writers, specialists about places and periods. That the first two books happen to be by myself is solely due to our need to bring out two Foundation-branded books quite rapidly. Kudiri Farm. And now to a final journey. In all the investigations of the past few years, perhaps none showed more potential, gave more enthusiasm, and in fact delight, than a journey I made in late 2007 in Sarawak, eastern Malaysia. For those few days epitomized the nascent foundation's core purpose, to return photos from institutions around the world to the photographs, places of origin. Documentary images abound for the period before Sarawak, like most of Asia, was engulfed by modernization. The photographs of K.F. Wong, of Lim Po Chiang, and, indeed, Hedda Morrison, who lived there for 20 years. Yet very few of these often compelling images ever have been published. In October 2007, I set out to visit one of the areas that Hedda Morrison photographed extensively, Negama, far up the turbid, silt-laden Rejang River. My aim was simply to sense the lie of the land. With a Hokkien boatman as my guide and interpreter, and a copy of Hedda's 1957 Negama book as my entree, I was spontaneously welcomed on the spot into Iban longhouses. Changes and continuities came into sharp focus. Better still, this brief reconnaissance brought me and the foundation face to face with individuals whom Hedda herself had photographed half a century ago. Reputedly the first outboard motor on the Rejang River and the Hokkien boatman. Now, lino on the longhouse floors, but broadly speaking, the social relationships remain similar. A wonderful informality and friendship, a true openness to strangers. The child is the woman. Garu was a longhouse headman greatly admired by Hedda, and he was her great Sarawakan friend. This is Garu's son, on his marriage day and the day we met. Near the end of my visit came a moment of transcendent recognition. The woman sees herself anew, the child she once was. For those alive when the original photos were taken, delight and pride at recalling long ago times. For the young, incredulity, sheer amazement that life once was so different, so seemingly simple. And so back to Hong Kong and the FCC today. If this TPHF graphic represents our door to the future, one person above all helped us put that door in place. Without his support, the foundation now only could be edging ahead. With his support, it has published its first book. On behalf of our chairman, Helmut Henning, the foundation board, and myself, for his steady encouragement, great generosity, and invaluable support, we thank sincerely our founding benefactor, Dr. Helmut Sermon. And with much pleasure, I also announce the launch of the photographic Heritage Foundation and the publication of its first book, Hong Kong as It Was. The Photographic Heritage Foundation series, number one. We hope there will be many more. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed, especially for sharing so many really remarkable photographs. We have about just under 20 minutes to take questions. The Ports East photographs you mentioned from a faraway archive, where is that archive?
I guess somebody would ask that question, but I rather hoped it wouldn't be you. One of the things our books really seek to do, and it's done in Hong Kong as it was, and categorically in every future book, is to give the greatest possible information about archives, about photographers' lives, histories, every detail possible for others to take it forward. But in a few cases, where we regard the photographs as such a find, a complete one-off, we simply have decided to be silent.
Okay, state secret. Any questions from the floor? While you're ruminating, I just to follow on from that, you've been to a lot of collections in the U.S. to find these photographs. What kind of collections are there to be discovered here in Asia, especially the libraries of Hong Kong, China?
Well, there certainly are collections to be discovered, but a point to bear in mind is that a lot of the photographs held in Europe, particularly America too, Australia, are there because of the effectively the process of colonies and imperialism. The album mentioned with the Afong photos was in the personal possession or the gift of a very significant figure who lived here long ago and retired to Europe. There definitely are collections here, but I would guess, in fact, the greater wealth is in Europe, the United States, and Australia.
And please identify yourself.
Nick Salnay-Smith. Ed, I know in the first Hedda Mollison book, and I guess in others, you've been very diligent in the captions of the photographs, explaining in as much detail as possible where they were taken. I'm sure many people in the room, like me, you get extraordinarily upset when you have a wonderful photograph of historic Hong Kong and you have absolutely no idea where it is. And there have been other books published in the last couple of months, which probably should be nameless, about classic Hong Kong, which still perpetrates these irritations. With these collections, are you going to be able to continue that? And if you find a photograph, which is a wonderful photograph, but you don't know where it was taken, are you going to exclude it because you can't place it geographically and historically, or will you sometimes allow them because of the photographic benefit?
That's a very interesting question. Thanks, Nick. I would say in the case that reflects in a sense on the whole process of photo editing, which is a kind of two or even a three-way street between an image's aesthetic qualities, an image's technical qualities, and an image's historical social content. Wherever possible, we'd be focusing on images that have all three qualities. But where, say, you had a wonderful image, and some of the Afong ones would be in that nature, in that there's a limit to what you can say about a series of broadly similar landscape photos of a river. There's not that much social content. But the first part of your comment, I'd really emphasize that we see our books as, in a sense, standing apart from quite a lot of others, because of the depth of content, in particular the photo captioning. I mentioned at the beginning, or earlier on, Jason Wordy and the comment about the tropical ulcers on the legs of those foreshore coolies. One of the really fascinating processes in creating Hedda Morrison's Hong Kong was the very, very lengthy dialogues I had with Jason and also with Victor Cheng through Chinese language, drawing out the hidden meanings of photographs. So in a nutshell, my answer would be we would absolutely desire all our photographs to have the greatest possible social, historical, and other content, but in some cases you would say an image simply stands on its own merits.
To the left, please.
Thank you very much, Ed. Tim Pearson Smith. One observation and one question. You mentioned that the book was printed in Singapore. Presumably that's for financial and technical reasons. Maybe you could elaborate on that. It's rather sad a book about Hong Kong is printed outside Hong Kong where there's such capability, maybe historic capability in that regard. The second point is, do you think that government recently has been saying there's a need to conserve heritage, physical heritage. Does government in Hong Kong have a responsibility to provide some funding for the preservation of such images of Hong Kong also?
To answer the first question, what we were doing, we were in fact very much guided here by Norman de Bracken, who has infinitely more experience than I do in managing print projects over decades, was seeking out a printer who could not only print a single book very well, but would have the capability to produce a whole series of books. And what we were particularly looking for was a printer who only printed books. Most printers print books, reports, cornflakes packets. We found a particular printer who happened to be in Singapore, so it's the printer in the company, not Singapore leading it, if you like, who only prints books, and in fact, of the books they print, 80% are for what you could call museum-quality work, Museum of Modern Art, Aperture, Tate, Yale, etc., etc. And we were a perfect fit there, and also there are other technical reasons to do with their particular system that I'd be happy to tell you about later. So for us, they're a perfect fit because of their very, very high-level quality aims and because the system there allows us to be certain of replicating books in the future rather than it being a one-off. Your second question about the Hong Kong government, yes, I would say they do. But sure. heritage is not just physical buildings, and obviously if you look only at physical buildings, even there the Hong Kong government effectively has been, as most people would say, very remiss. But were they to broaden it to other things, yes, of course, that would be great.
Is there a Hong Kong government photo archive? We probably have time for another question or two from the floor, if there is one.
We've recently had a government spend $400 million to maintain the King Ying Lei Mansion on Stubbs Road. What would you rather have, $400 million for a King Ying Lei Mansion or $4 million for a photographic archive?
Oh, well, that's a that's one of those sort of devil in the deep blue sea type questions. It relates to the last one, and obviously they shouldn't be mutually exclusive propositions. One thing I think you could say in terms of what we're trying to do is that if the material is really properly disseminated, so in other words, it's not only books but above all websites, exhibitions and so on, the value dollar for dollar is probably just as great in publishing projects, particularly if they reach out into the community. And I might add here that we're having very interesting discussions with the Link about doing just that, which is using the Hedda Morrison photographs to be taken out into their malls, which is obviously a great thing because of the scope of their malls and how they can reach out into the wider community. When the original book was published, incidentally, a very strong memory with the exhibitions. And there was this palpable sense of older people being absolutely moved by the remembrance of their youth, and young people, as I said, with the Sarawak photos, being stunned by what they never knew. But nonetheless, those exhibitions were in places like particularly Hong Kong U, which is obviously a fairly refined, specialised venue, and we would be absolutely thrilled to see our photos taken really effectively out into the wide community.
Did the people in Sarawak, did they remember Hedda Morrison coming and taking those photos? What did they tell you about that? And also, can you also tell us a bit more about Ah Fong? Where was he from, and do we know how he got into taking landscape photography ahead of his time?
As I said about Sarawak, I literally had gone there to sense the lie of the land, a trip to get a feeling for what was there, because her photographs of Sarawak, although they're other fine photographers of the place and period, really are the compelling record of modern Sarawak before its economic transformation. The people, effectively, I was led to by a Hokkien boatman, and we kind of jumped around between longhouses as people saw the book I had and said, no, you need the longhouse up there. So we went there, and then we finally found those people. Yes, they did remember her, particularly because, as some may know if they've read the book, Hedda did have, she was very small, and she had a limp. And, gosh, that's a piece of heritage falling down. We better call in somebody, the government.
Ed, it happens all the time. So it's, don't worry.
I think you might call that a bolt from the blue. Yes, they did remember Hedda as the lady with the camera, and also because her husband was a district officer, and he was a very, very tall man. So they were a recognizable pair. Your other question, Ah Fong. Ah Fong was born in, it's believed, 1839 in China. He came here about 20 years later. It's believed he was completely self-taught as a photographer. He is indeed, if you read World Histories of Photography, the only Chinese photographer of the 19th century who has a name, a place in history. And his studio ran, in fact, until the almost before the Second World War. He himself died in 1890, but he did leave this compelling body of beautiful landscape photographs.
We have one last question in the back before the roof falls in.
Hi, this is Venus Wu from Reuters. I have two questions for you. The first thing is, you have obviously given a lot yourself in the pursuit of this project, personally, financially. So why are you doing this? And secondly, is you've been to a lot of places around the world. You've been to Singapore, China, everywhere. And can you compare how the different governments in different countries, like how they work to preserve historical photographs?
Thank you. Why do I do it? Well, I could give a kind of flippant answer. That's what I like doing, something like that. But I think in a real sense, because I'm a photographer myself, I see a real connection with these other photographers. And in particular, I myself in the late 80s had a long period of great frustration getting two of my Australian books published that took a great deal of time to become published because of the cost of the projects. And it was really through those projects that I learned a lot about publishing and, in fact, because of that, set up the precursor body, the HKCP Foundation. And I think what that period of my life told me and later events proved is that if one can do something to publish photographs by photographers who committed great amounts of their lives and commitment and feeling to their work, then besides the benefit to the societies that they photographed, you're actually doing a benefit to those photographers. But it's not only obviously altruistic things such as that. It's work I enjoy doing. So I think that would probably be the best answer to that question. The second one, I would tend to sidestep, but only for this reason, that there's so many places and their economic, social conditions, their histories are so fundamentally different to kind of compare what they do with historical photos is perhaps a little invidious. So I would say, for example, to compare what Hong Kong might do with historical photos and what China might do is something of an unfair question, because Hong Kong has advantages in its economic, educational, social development that China does not yet have. But that said, there's a very wide spectrum of attitude to photography and culture across the region.
Go ahead, you have a follow-up, yeah.
Well, Singapore, I think, for people who visit the place, has a greater regard for its heritage. If you look at its built heritage, that's very clear. And they certainly have larger institutions. But again, in a way, the comparison is a little flawed because Singapore's a nation and has been for, what, the best part of 50 years. But yes, I would say Singapore has a greater regard for heritage, physical, social, cultural, than perhaps Hong Kong does.
Terrific. Ed, thanks very much. Please join me in thanking Ed today. We'll look forward to the books as they come out, especially the Mysterious Ports East collection. Ed, thank you very much.
And there's a copy here for the answers.
If anyone in the room does have a book they want Ed to sign, he'll be up here for a bit, so feel free.
I'm assuming you got no one that wanted to know about this.
I want cancel. You can argue it, but I'm going to be argue the word for cancel. Because 12,000.
No, I as I say, I don't read it myself. Let's say it's spending on somebody else.
Well, I mean, don't
No, we don't.
Are there no German people?
No.
Okay, I mean, I just look at 12,000.
It was like, what's his name? Rafael, not Rafael. He was at that time on the board.